Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Today, my guest on the Alpha Exchange is Jim Grant, the founder and editor of Grant's Interest Rate Observer. A gunner's mate in the Navy and a graduate of Indiana University, Jim ventured to the financial desk at the Baltimore Sun in the early 1970s. He joined Barron's in 1975 before launching his own firm in 1983. For more than three decades, Grant's has twice monthly landed on the desktop of its readers, providing analysis that is deeply insightful, often skeptical, and always written in Jim's uniquely compelling style. My conversation with Jim covers the bad old inflation days of the early 1980s and the courage of Paul Volcker. We also discuss the many lessons Jim's learned through different risk cycles and touch on negative interest rates and Jim's view on the damage done to the price discovery process wrought by the interventionist activities of the modern central banker. He even shares his views on the National Weather Service in the course of our excellent conversation. Gold enthusiast, Fed critic, entrepreneur, accomplished author, and father of four, Jim Grant is a legendary figure in the markets business. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did on this episode of the Alpha Exchange. Jim, it is a real pleasure to have you here today. Welcome to the Alpha Exchange.
Well, thank you, Dean. Nice to be here.
Well, Jim, we've got a fair amount of ground to cover today, and I think we'll have a really interesting conversation. I'd always love to start with the guest's career path, and I think for you, it's an especially interesting one. Give us a brief summary of your time up until the founding of Grant's Interest Rate Observer, and then tell us...
Well, kind of a blur, Dean.
It may be. But you had the foresight and the sort of risk-taking personality to start your own firm amidst a massive bear market in fixed income, amidst some high inflation days. Walk us through your time, a little bit about your background up until that point, and then the launching of Grant's.
So I was born in 1946. Let's get accuracy is important here. And that was, as you well know, Dean, that was the year one of what would prove to be a 35-year bond bear market. My landmarks in life are all, of course, aligned with developments in fixed income. So I grew up in the middle of Long Island and was to have been either a first baseman for the Brooklyn Dodgers or a professional French horn player. I was much better at the horn than I was hitting a baseball. But I even gave up playing French horn and went into the Navy, where I was a gunner's mate for the USS Hornet aircraft carrier. And then I went to college and I studied economics, which for all I knew was an actual science. It turned out to be an art. I did some graduate studies at Columbia after that, and this takes us up to about 1972 or thereabouts. And my first actual job, apart from a few broken stints on Wall Street, which are actually quite formative, but my first real day-to-day job was at the Baltimore Sun. I was determined to be a journalist, and indeed I have been all these many years. And at the Baltimore Sun, I wound up taking a job on the financial desk because, Dean, nobody else wanted it. It was the lowest status post on a newspaper. And it still is not exactly Watergate caliber, but it has come up a little bit in prestige. Anyway, I got in at the bottom of the cycle of financial journalism, I guess. And a few years later, I went to Barron's. This takes us to 1975, and I was at Barron's for about 8 years. And owing to an utterly petty intramural political squabble among the head men of the time, I felt I had to leave, and what to do? I still have a wife. We had then two kids on our way, ultimately to four. So watching television was not an option. So what to do? A job. Yes, I must get a job. So I looked around and could not really imagine writing for anything else. Barron's was then a kind of a writer's paper. You said what you liked, more or less in your own voice. So I thought, well, you know what I'll do? I will start a business. I had the misapprehension that the world did not have enough to read. It turns out the world had more than enough then and more than enough now. But with great bravado, more than foresight, certainly, I started Grant's. And in the autumn of 1983, I believe I took my first salary about 3 years later.
Wow.
My wife was working at Lehman. That was so long ago that Lehman was solvent. And Patricia not content to have achieved, she was a reporter at the Baltimore Sun as well, where we married, but she went on to, she got an MBA, worked at Lehman, had the aforementioned four kids, and got it into her head that, yes, she would become a doctor.
Wow.
And did become a doctor. She's a practicing neurologist. So that is a short... You asked for a short resume, Dean. I've gone for about, half an hour.
Well, that gets us to 1983, which I see you started your firm amidst a raging rally in bonds that took the 10-year from 16% in 1981 to 11% yield to maturity in and around 1983.
That was the days, Dean.
Yeah. So tell us about those days. What was the prevailing consensus around things like inflation? Tell us a little bit about the Volcker era and his more stringent application of monetary economics.
Yes. Well, it's also clear in retrospect. And in retrospect, we can see that commodity prices peaked in 1979-80. Gold certainly peaked in January of 1980, about $850 an ounce. President Reagan broke the strike of the air controllers in, I think, 1981, maybe. And again, in retrospect, you can see that yes, the bond market did peak in yield, bottomed in price on September 30th, 1981, the long bond, 30-year bond, then at about 15% intraday, I think exactly 15% intraday. So as you know, there is such a thing in markets as muscle memory. The CFAs give it way too little appreciation, I think. But interest rates had been zigging irregularly but persistently upward since 1946. And so 35 years is a lot of experience. So people naturally were skeptical of a turn, as they always are at major turns. Paul Volcker was the new monetary chieftain, and he came in. He was a man of, is still, Paul Volcker is very much with us, but he was... As the Fed chairman, he was a man of great resolution, but not fixed conviction with respect to money and banking. He was a pragmatist who saw that the improvisational methods of the Carter era had failed, and he had an abiding and quite, I think, a morally based loathing of inflation, which certainly stood him in good stead. But he was not a dogmatic monetarist, nor was he a dogmatic anything, really. He certainly was not a gold standard guy. Read his memoir, he has a little bit of a wistful view of the passing of Bretton Woods, but he does not, nor did he then believe that a revaluation of the dollar value of gold and a new era of a gold-like standard was called for. He was a fiat money guy. He is a fiat money guy and a regulation guy. So Paul Volcker implemented what in Victorian Britain was called the screw.
Hmm.
And the screw is the raising of rates and the tightening of liquidity conditions, and he did that to a fairly well. And nowadays, it just seems impossible to believe that it happened. Can you imagine? So he comes in October, or the late summer of 1979, and his first major policy declaration is that a Saturday press conference, I think October 6, 1979, lovely fall day. And he says, in a kind of way that was puzzled most people, I said, we are going to constrict the growth of bank reserves and let interest rates go where they might. And I still remember, so we came, all of us employees at Barron's came in to work on that Monday. And Alan Abelson said something to the effect, this is a very big deal. And indeed, it was a long bond, and that weekend was 9%. IBM had just sold a long-dated issue of nines. And as you can imagine, they did not stay at 9 for long. Interest rates went straight up. So come the spring of 1980, the long bond was at 10, and presently 11 and 12. And if you were bullish at 9, if you were bullish at 6, 6 was a number rarely seen in yields. That was kind of an exotic thing at the time, but now we're talking about 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Can you imagine a U.S. Treasury security yielding 13% outside of the British burning down the public buildings of Washington, D.C., which in fact happened during the War of 1812, but this is not the War of 1812. This is a time of more or less peace. So these extraordinary figures are just wheeled by. So finally 15%. Okay, so that's the turn. but nobody issues a press release. Many investors observed that a mid-teens return on a treasury instrument was an equity return with no equity risk, and these securities were non-callable for 25 years, the 30 above. Furthermore, and now I'm skipping ahead a couple of years, 1982 maybe, Salomon Brothers and other firms came out with zero coupon instruments. They took a feline theme. There were cats and tigers and lions.
Yes.
And you bought them at 25 or 30 and they went to par.
Yep.
Unfailingly, they went to par.
Yes.
So the internal rate of return was in the teen. Can you imagine an instrument like that? And I will tell you how many people, some people in fact saw them for what they were, but on the whole, this was not the revelation. It was not received as the revelation that indeed it was.
It's easy to see it now, looking at the chart.
Oh, yes.
But not then.
Yeah. So you asked a long time ago now, you asked how people, what they thought of Volcker, what they thought of this business about unprecedentedly high treasury yields, and what they thought was, yeah, this is what you get for an imbalance in the federal finances. A lot of worry about the treasury deficit.
So I think there's a certain credit that folks want to give to Volcker, rightly so, for... call it bravery of saying this is what we're trying to accomplish.
Steadfastness.
And I think you would certainly be in the camp that the current day architecture of not just the Fed, but other large central banks have no such steadfastness. Is it fair to say that Volcker back in that time period did not have to tend to this just gigantic financialization of assets, of the daisy chain of counterparty risk, of this vastness of OTC derivatives, these time bombs, at least potentially so, and credit creation that just has become more the lifeblood of the economy? Was it simpler for him?
I think it's another case of retrospect. I think we can see now that there was not so much complexity in finance, nor were we as deeply wired one to the other with regard to the instruments you just mentioned. But we ought not to underestimate the difficulties he did face. Everyone thought there was a lot of debt. In fact, it took the United States of America to achieve its first $1 trillion of debt. It took that until 1982, I think. That was the first year we hit $1 trillion. That seemed like a big deal. And then under the Reagan defense buildup and the spending that entailed, the second $1 trillion occurred, I think, in 86, maybe. It was not so long after the first $1 trillion. So the backdrop was one of great credit creation, certainly within the public sector. But there wasn't what we have come to see since 2006 and 7. That wasn't this network, this seemingly impenetrable network with the mind-boggling numbers of commas and zeros attached to these instruments. It wasn't that at the time, no. I'm trying to think of the year that Continental Illinois Bank and Trust, that was 1984. That was one of the major banks in the country, certainly among, I think, the top 10. And it got on the wrong side of this move in interest rates and was a goner. And the Fed and the OCC and other regulators came in. And it wasn't exactly nationalized, but there were guarantees put in place such that the doctrine of too big to fail came into the forefront after that episode in 1984. Let me take a quick detour to describe the action in
Please.
The year. So nowadays, I think that after tax and after inflation, there's no point in the Treasury yield curve that delivers a real return to an investor. Not one point. 1984, there's a retest of the lows in price, highs in yield in the Treasury market. It seems that's the way, doesn't it? When there's a big move and there's a turn and then, you know, paid right away because they take it back the other direction just to see how sincere you are.
Right. Yep.
Mr. Market's way of teasing you. And there was a retest of the highs in yield in 1984, in the spring of 84. So the high, of course, was 15%. We're talking 30-year security. About the time that Continental Illinois Bank and Trust was hitting the wall, the market retested 14%. And all sorts of theories about why this was so, none of them, in retrospect, anything to recall, and I certainly don't recall them all, but none of them really explained anything. What did happen, never mind the theories, was the most remarkable second chance for the needy saver in the history of thrift. What the market wanted you to know was that it could be yours. These things we mentioned, the cats and the tigers and the lions, were out there in force. These securities then maybe it was like 30 cents on the dollar that was your cost, and then it would go to par. I forgot the numbers. Whatever the internal rate of return was, it would deliver 13 7/8 or 14%. But 14% was yours for the asking for just a little while in the spring of 1984, but it was there at a time when the CPI was printing at less than 4% year over year. There was 9 percentage points plus of real yield.
That is remarkable.
And again, you'd think, living as we do now, that creditors living hand to mouth and taking the most extraordinary risk for the least dazzling of returns, you would expect that, what were we thinking of? Now these people I see in your office, are some of them look old enough to vote, not all of them. Not that they are incompetent, Dean. That's an aside to Dean's customer. They all look brilliant, but some of them do look rather young. I'm 72, fine. But the parents of the people now entering the business turned the nose at 14%.
Right.
9 percentage points of real yield. It's so humbling. I think this is one of the reasons we should know a little bit about the financial past, because you are reminded of the extremes and how little we appreciate extremes for what they are at the time. So it doesn't take much for insight to see that perhaps the mirror image of that 9 plus percentage points of real yield in the spring of 1984 was, or in 2016, when it was something like $12 trillion worth of securities priced to yield less than nothing.
Yep, nominally.
And, yeah. And you couldn't get enough of them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you have this very unique appreciation for an ability to describe not just the recent financial history, because folks like me I'm trying to impress upon some of the younger professionals in the business that I interact with that things like long-term capital, that matters. That happened and that's relevant. That should be relevant to an appreciation for the things that can go wrong and how wrong they can go. But you go way back. There's that old saying, history is a foreign country.
Yeah, the past is a foreign country.
Yeah, the past is a foreign country. And I'd like to say that the past history of risk is especially a foreign country.
Well, isn't it? The past is, of course, the details change, but the narrative remains the same.
Yeah.
It's from the underpricing of, I'm talking now, ladies and gentlemen, to a professional in this line of work, but I would say, Dean, that the story of risk is the episodic underpricing and overpricing of risk.
Right.
And of course, the details change, the personalities obviously change, the techniques change. I got in the business, after I got out of the Navy, I got a job on Wall Street before I went to college. Before I returned to college, I had a one semester dry run. In 1967, people were still using slide rules, and the way information moved within a firm was through pneumatic tubes. So the technology was primitive, but the psychology was exactly as it is today. And therefore, the patterns of excess in either direction were remarkably similar, or ours are remarkably similar to those.
I think maybe we'll fast forward a little bit to some of the dynamics of today's environment or the recent past. And to your point about the underpricing or overpricing of risk that tends to exist for sometimes stretched periods of time, longer than you would think. What I have observed is that you can always be, and I'm not taking any credit away from John Paulson, who nailed this mortgage trade in 2007, but a lot of folks who had done similar research were just a year or two early. And I can say forcefully that to be early was very painful, and it was too difficult to carry those trades.
Oh, it was brutal. I mean, I write about it, John Paulson and you and so many others actually not only take the risk, but it's a small, distinction between taking risk and bearing it. Right. You as an entrepreneur do both, but most people in our line of work only take it, right? They don't bear it, except with respect to a bonus. That's not the same thing. That's not your reputation and your livelihood and in the firm you built. But what struck me so much about John Paulson's achievements was the steadfastness, courage in the face of great negative reinforcement. We certainly got it journalistically. Dan Gertner, who did so much of the work at Grants for this, and I were summoned to S&P to be dressed down at one point in 2007, I guess, or incorrect and noisy provocations to the expertness that S&P brought to this analysis, you know, blah, blah, blah. But Paulson, carrying these positions, leveraged positions, I suppose, having made a lot of money, then chose to not to close out the trade during the pullbacks. And the pullbacks were, as you know, you never forget, I'm sure, were substantial.
Yeah, these things take a long time to to fester. Even though it felt fast moving, it took quite a long time. And I think some of this is when we look at these long periods of over and underpricing of risk, when you step back and you look at the Barclays Ag Index for corporate bonds at its lows in nominal yields, boy, you see something that's just so patently unattractive. And there's well north of $1 trillion indexed to this thing. And you just have to ask yourself, does anyone think this is a good deal? Or do they just acknowledge that it's in the Chuck Prince, the music's still on, we're still dancing, this is the cycle, we can't change it? And is it the case, and this is where I wanted to shift to, is it just the case that the Fed and the other central banks have just gotten so big and so interventionist and heavy-handed in terms of where risk clears in price that investors have just kind of thrown up their hands? Just really quickly, when I first got to the business, I just remember this was 1991. I worked for the chief economist at Nomura Securities, David Ressler, and our mission was Fed watching. It was a different era, obviously, but the narrative was all the Fed is trying to win the confidence from the markets so that they can reduce long-dated inflation expectations and continue to bring the term premium down. And we're coming out of 2 or 3 years of roughly zero to negative term premium. Have the markets just surrendered to the Fed? And are we in this early stage of that coming out of the markets?
I think the markets have, if you take it down to the level of the individuals in the market, we at Grants preach about this stuff, but people who do this for a living, who actually take positions and who try to wring some yield out of these most reluctant securities, they have to take the world as it is. And that's surrendering to the Fed, you can put it that way. If you talk to people who manage money in Europe who try to get something above zero out of these securities, I had a conversation with one, a very intelligent guy who is among the leading investors in European fixed income, having generated a return of as many as a dozen basis points or something. In the land of zero, this is a couple of years ago, I said, look at Netflix, for Pete's sake. I mean, it's all very well, these people who, even then running massive negative free cash flow, it's all very well for the stockholders if this works out, because it has worked out certainly brilliantly for the stock. What's in it for the creditors? And he said, well, what's in it for this creditor is like 25 basis points. And that for him is a year maker. So it all depends where you sit. And yeah, so I said, I guess to that extent, the markets have caved in. You know, it is written that in the late 1940s, that the head of the Equitable Insurance Company was out there saying, as nobody, almost nobody in a position of financial responsibility is saying today, that what the central banks did then, they were in the business of financial suppression, was inexpedient. And he, I think, virtually said it was immoral. And he said, we're not going to put up with it. And we at the Equitable are not going to buy any securities beyond yielding less than 3%. And that was the reigning corporate bond yield in years past. And financial repression stayed in place in the late 1940s, and they, sure enough, they capitulated and began to buy the 2 7/8. So the yields might be off slightly, but they had to get with the program, because the program is called the market. It's called what is. And I think what people are capitulating to is what is.
Let's go back. We talked a little bit about negative interest rates. It's such an interesting, almost philosophical topic to give someone money and just demand less than that.
The demanded. We're not going to settle for anything.
That's it. It's sort of like I was trying to come up with an analogy of a bank robber who reverse robs the bank and sort of forces money upon the bank and runs out or something like that. I wanted to get your reaction to a couple of quotes. Janet Yellen, and this was in one of the down periods. This was a little bit before Brexit, before I think the U.S. 10-year bottomed out at about 1.35% post-Brexit. But February 16, we were in one of these quasi-strong disinflation periods. China was melting down. Crude oil had come down dramatically. And Yellen, in a interview of some kind, said about negative rates, she said, we're taking a look at them. I wouldn't take those off the table.
I remember that vividly. That was 2016.
Yeah.
The Fed had just implemented its first little rate hike, went to 25 basis points, and everyone was...
Yeah.
And no sooner The stock market had pulled back by, what, 10 percentage points or something like that. Right. In January, it was a bloodbath. I get a kick when they say it's a bear market is down 20%. You know, so no, a bear market is when you don't want to go to work in the morning. That's right. A bear market. But anyway, so the markets were, shall we say, difficult. But it only took that few percentage points of loss for the chairman of the Fed to come out and say, we're thinking about negative rates, having raised once. And I think that struck the tone. That, to me, was the sounding of the gong, if you needed another gong, about how little tolerance the Fed had for financial trouble of any kind. I think maybe, to put a better gloss on it, the Fed is not unaware. The Fed, which is a strong suit, is not self-awareness, but perhaps even the Fed is not unaware of the fact that after 8 or 10 years of artificially low interest rates, the world adjusts to them and capitalizes itself for them.
What are the implications of the behemoth, the global reserve currency, the United States, and the biggest central bank, even contemplating negative rates? What does that say about their confidence or maybe lack of it?
I think it says, most of all, it speaks to the almost the institutional arrogance. You know, I'm all for American exceptionalism. I do believe the Declaration of Independence is singular. But it is one thing to extol and appreciate what this country has wrought. It's quite another to assert in words and deeds that it is our choice whether and how much of our currency to dump into the world's lap and say, take it at par. Reserve currency business, I think, is a poison chalice. It's the invitation which we have availed ourselves of monumentally. It's the invitation to borrow and spend. The external financial position of this country is deeply negative. We are running, this is going to sound somewhat sermon-esque, but just to review, we are running a $1 trillion unified budget deficit in this era of supposed blooming prosperity. And we have gone from our first trillion of public debt in 1982 to what, 22 and rising 23. And the progression from the first trillion to the 22nd trillion is...
it's a quick one.
You went to the University of Chicago. Is that an arithmetic progression? Or is that
yeah, right, exactly.
We have this magic carpet ride of a reserve currency. And so what does it say about the Fed? It says that the Fed has perfect freedom of action. It's not constrained. It can do whatever it wants, and the world will take our currency. Maybe we're the cleanest, dirty shirt and forever will be. Maybe I'm too much a child of the 20th century's financial inflationary episodes to appreciate the latent deflationary risk and the fact that negative nominal rates may indeed be in our future. I don't see it.
In 2015, Bernanke, I think he was probably talking about forward guidance, he said monetary policy is 98% talk and only 2% action. How does that strike you?
That is true these days. Way back when, it was no talk. And that's of loquacity is a new thing. I mean, the idea of playing tonsil tennis with the market, forever talking at the market, giving speeches, giving forward guidance, writing papers, hiring PhDs to write more, all this is relatively new. William McChesney Martin wanted not one PhD on the staff, and he finally got some despite himself. And even as recently as Volcker, the idea of speaking in tongues, you know, of giving testimony and not saying anything, this was thought to be the high art of central banking rhetoric. And then came the counter-revolution of lots of talk and lots of clarity. In a way, it's like I had a recent fairly benign experience in operating. I was the patient, not the doctor, you'd be happy to know. And a very light touch on the anesthesia. And I got to hear everything the doctors were saying. I don't know. I kind of liked it, but I couldn't hear them.
Right.
I think the TMI problem is now endemic in the world of central banking, as it was in my operating room on Monday. Shut up. I don't want to hear about doctor wanting another chisel.
I think the markets will always lean against the certainty that they're provided. And I think this is one of the things the Fed's trying to get itself out of, and it's finding it tricky.
Yeah, there's a eminent British monetary advisor and economist. I'll think it's about midnight. I'll give you a call, Dean. But the gentleman in question wrote a book about the state of affairs in the New York money market from 1900 to 1913. And he said that never has a monetary system worked so well. This is notwithstanding the panic in 1907. And he said that the secret of this was the uncertainty about the level of short-term rates. Money market rates were set on the New York Stock Exchange. There was a money post. And you bought and sold call loans. That was the Fed funds rate was the call loan rate, the margin loan rate of the day. And the rates were wildly volatile, of 20% to 2% in a week or a day. And the uncertainty of the cost of funding a bank outside of the world of deposits or safety. Safety was that a banking attribute, was a franchise value because there's no deposit insurance. So the uncertainty attendant upon funding costs limited the bank's ability to borrow short and lend long, lent stability to credit. And this author in question is nameless because of my advancing number of birthdays. This author identified this uncertainty as a constructive element in the monetary affairs of New York City preceding the institution of the Fed in 1914. So fast forward many years, 100 years, and now we have all this uncertainty, all this information, and guidance, yes, guidance, and dot point, plot, you know, whatever they are, points.
Yeah.
Pencil points. So people tee off, right? Knowing or thinking they know what's going to happen, you lever up.
Exactly.
What you want is people get a little uncomfortable in the batter's box, right?
I think that's part of it, and I wanted to quote Yogi Berra and then ask you to talk a little bit about some of your recent thinking and some of what you've articulated on this broad topic of uncertainty. So Yogi Berra, amongst his many yogiisms, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future.
Amen.
I love that one. So tell us about the weatherman and tell us about the Fed.
Meteorology is a science, unlike economics, which is an aspirational science. And the National Weather Service, a fine organization, employs more than 2,000 people, has a $1 billion budget, has computing power equal to 10,000 times the Dell on your desk, and takes 77 billion annual observations. Now, Dean, that is called big data. Those are called big data. Excuse me, grammarians. That's the Weather Service. And from time to time, they bungle it, as they did November 15th. Remember this? There was 6 inches of snow. And for all the Minnesota listeners, just forgive us, okay? But the city went nuts and recriminations. It was just awful. 6 inches of snow. But it wasn't forecast.
Yeah.
Yeah. With all these billions of observations, something. Okay, so that's the weather. And the Fed is meant to be accurate in its forecast, its model. By the way, happens not to incorporate the financial sector. Yeah, a little oversight there.
That might matter.
But the Fed is meant to forecast the future, not of inanimate raindrops, but of human beings, willful human beings, who will do what they can to confound the forecasters. So the conceit of the Fed, to me, is just laughable. And I think you share a little bit of this, Dean, I think, but insofar as you do, we two are about alone. The people in our line of work just hang on the words of the Fed. The Fed is still, I think, a much revered institution. People just say they saved us in 2008, their dual mandate. To me, the dual mandate of the Fed is arsonist and fireman. That's it.
That's well said. You were on one of the financial shows.
Couldn't help it, Dean.
You couldn't help it. Now you're on the Alpha Exchange. That's excellent.
Much better company.
And you said that you thought Powell will blink, and he decidedly blinked.
You know, I regretted that when I said, I think it trivialized the job he does and the decisions he's got to take. And now I'm speaking out with a little two tongues. If I had my way, the monetary system would be rather different, but then let's talk about the way things are. So the way things are, you're not supposed to tighten into a recession. That leads you to a worse than dead end and marks you down for your entire career as a financial war criminal. You hurt a lot of people. So look at the setup in early December, late November, whatever it was, around Thanksgiving, Christmas time, flattening yield curve, commodity markets breaking, stock market obviously breaking, volatility rising, bond market doing what they didn't want it to do. Gee, are we supposed to tighten in the face of this? Well, shall we not be resolute? Paul Volcker was resolute. Are we spineless? So you can imagine, as you put yourself in position of this poor guy, I'm talking now about Jay Powell. So yeah, he blinked. But you look at the setup he's got. You mentioned financialization before, D. Dean. I mean, he has a look at the companies, look at the industries that are dependent upon the existing structure of rates and the existing terms and conditions of obtaining credit. Look at SoftBank, look at Uber, look at Lyft, look at WeWork, look at the entire private equity spectrum, look at the federal government of the United States of America. Everyone needs what they've got, which is liquidity and low rates. Is it possible that we can't get above 3%? I don't know. It's plenty of smart people say that. This very good woman who does macro mavens. I should not forget her name. Stephanie Pomboy. Yeah. Said we can't go above 3%. Well, that hypothesis is still on the table.
Right.
And if so, I guess we ought to recognize it. But I doubt that. But so anyway, I said that he blinked. He did blink. But I want to at least give him the respect that he is due holding position he does. I think it's the wrong position, the wrong kind of monetary structure. Everything's wrong with it, except he's stuck.
I just wonder if amongst the dashboard that he looks at, growth, inflation, some more real time than other in terms of the frequency of the data, but we've got this instantaneous report card called the VIX and the S&P, and we stare at that all day long. And I just wonder if this was the asset prices are telling us something that the economy can't yet express, or the asset prices via the wealth effect are scary enough that this more market-oriented dislocation, you know, he was very specific about trying to walk the market off the cliff.
Years and years ago, either Charles Dow or William Peter Hamilton, one of the two great progenitors of the Dow theory and its application wise, one of them said, coming events first cast their shadow across the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. That was the turn of the 20th century. And the stock exchange is not what it was, of course. So you could say they first cast their shadow across the floor of the stock exchange with now a CNBC set.
Yeah, right.
But still, the idea that markets do know things, know in quotation marks, know things that mere mortal economists may not know, and certainly the Fed may not know, I think that is something to be reckoned with. And certainly the part of wisdom might have been to blink, as I put it. But I think standing back and not casting blame or casting empathy towards public actors, I'd say we're stuck. And I say we're stuck with a structure of finance that has now become deeply dependent upon what is not good for it. So what do we do about that? I think that there will come a time when people are forced to confront the remote and fundamental cause of this problem, which is the PhD standard, which is the creation of massive volumes of credit and the manipulation of the entire yield curve of not one country, but many countries, for the very purpose of making us more dependent. And people will see this and they'll demand some sort of reform in the basic protocols of money and banking, at least I hope. But that's a journalist's or an expounder's hope. It's not a practitioner's hope.
Let's shift. We touched on a little bit the collision between the White House and the Fed.
And the collision between the so-called real economy and the financial world.
That's for sure. And that's ongoing. I think it was Ron Paul in 2012 that would have had you at the helm of the Fed.
Yeah. And somebody on Bloomberg said, it's one of these messages that stream said, quote, that would be interesting.
It would be interesting, taking some Twitter heat from Trump. So I want you to comment on that. And then I also would love to hear your thoughts on, I just would call it, and this is totally apolitical, it feels like there's a fair amount of White House dysfunction. There's a source of vol here called the White House itself, or called the administration, that, again, left, right, center, I don't know that we've seen some of this stuff before. And, you know, maybe tying that back to hedging, or I know you've been a gold enthusiast for years.
It only seems that way.
So let's start with the White House's tendency to, and Trump specifically, to feel like he's intervening and making very, very distinct commentary is fair game. Does that matter?
Yeah, it should matter. You know, Donald Trump is not a new figure for those of us in the New York City financial community. We've known him for more than 30 years. He's the guy who abused his balance sheet, who maybe set some kind of indoor record on bankruptcy and won junk bonds in one company, who doesn't always pay his debts. I mean, he's those are deeds. He's rhetorically on record as saying what we need is renegotiation of the public debt. And that was lighthearted, maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was. But he is, shall we say, a little more lighthearted with respect to the solemn business of borrowing and lending, as are many other people. And what he wants and what he asserts that he wants is very low interest rates and a real estate developer's dream, long-dated, indeed perpetual securities, priced to yield about nothing. That's his setup. That's the preferred setup. And I don't know, way back, not so way back when, but a look askance at the Fed by somebody in the Oval Office or somebody in the White House would have elicited at least a couple of dozen basis points of agita.
Right.
Maybe the world is just, that's just Donald Trump. And maybe that's the right thing to think. Well, you know what? Donald Trump can't fire Jay Powell, but Jay Powell could fire Trump. So maybe Trump is within his rights a little bit. So I happen to think that that Congress, which is the Fed's boss, ought to be more interventionist with respect to its creation and demand a greater accounting. But anyway, that again is an opinion. It has nothing to do with making money in this market.
We talked a little bit before about this. We've never been here before with 3.7 unemployment or 3.9, and we're going to print $1 trillion deficit. It's just, those things happening contemporaneously is just off the charts.
In so many other ways, this particular setup is unprecedented. And usually things are with precedent. We've been doing this business of buying low and selling high or vice versa for millennia. So nothing is really new, except nowadays, actually, things are a little bit new. July 2016 print in the 10-year was the lowest so-called risk-free rate over 700 years. And there's, even now, last time I looked in Bloomberg, there's more than $8 trillion security price to yield less than nothing. That is a new thing in the 3,000-year recorded history of interest rates. I think there's room for a lot of opinions, but there maybe is not room for dogmatism. Although, to be sure, the great moneymakers of the world, when they think they know, get really dogmatic, and they press and they press. That's dogmatism. It's pressing. And that's the way to make a lot of money. But for me, I am so struck by the various possibilities for both for good outcomes and really, really scary ones.
Back to gold. I'm going back to 2011. And that was the real spike in gold and its volatility at the same time. It really happened. It was happening. And you spoke at a dinner we hosted in 2009, made a very prescient call on the directionality of gold. By 2011, it was up, but it just ramped in and around the debt ceiling showdown. Boehner and his team and Obama on the other side, and the market just had a freak out. And a lot of that risk off or defensive capital, certainly ironically, as the U.S. was on the verge of default, people were buying treasuries hand over fist in a risk off, but gold had a tremendous run. And when I think about what I see in terms of this shutdown, and then there's another debt ceiling date coming up, and they'll buy some time. But I'm just wondering, when you look at gold now, as a recipient of capital that comes about when things are especially dysfunctional or people are confused, how do you look at gold right now?
Well, I'm very bullish on it. I'm talking now and playing to type. One should never become proverbial in this business. You're supposed to be flexible and always interesting. I became rather a bore on the subject of gold. But to me, a bond is a promise to pay money. And so what I ask, what few people ask, is that perhaps it's not relevant in day-to-day business, but what I insist on asking is, okay, what is money? Is money that thing which they can be conjured from a computer terminal at the Fed in the trillions without anybody raising a sweat? Is that really money? Is that a store of value? What's the nature of it? If something is so easily conjurable, is that really what we used to know as money? I think not. I think that the entire structure of the entire panoply of wealth is weightless, no? And it's share certificates used to, when I got in the business, they were trundled around Wall Street by guys called runners, a misnomer. Most of them weren't running. Some were not walking. Bearer bond certificates. So the paper evidences of wealth were tangible. Those things are now intangible. Money, of course, was tangible. It still is in the basement of the Federal Reserve. That's either it's furniture down there, monetary furniture, or it's. But as things have tended towards weightlessness, the nature of money is, in fact, insubstantial, not of substance, and it can therefore be easily replicated and is. The Bank of Japan, ECB, Fed, and the ease of replication has spawned all sorts of consequences. If we spawn a bond market that in Europe is just the most amazing spectacle. A while ago, you saw junk bonds with zero handles in Europe. So the weightlessness of money has contributed to the mispricing of credit. And insofar as credit is mispriced, it is the evidence of the misallocation of real resources, of things, of people. And misallocations tend to force their restructuring in the shape of a financial crisis. That's what a crisis is about. It's like, oh, we made a mistake. What do corrections correct? They correct the misallocation of things and people. So I think our weightless money and our misallocated credit will someday force a substantial repricing that will take the shape of a now in quotes again, bear market in many asset classes. And that will be scary, and the Fed will be tempted to make things right, and in so doing make things worse, or at least prolong the problem. But from such a bear market come in terrific opportunity. I mean, look back at 2009, my goodness. So the world never ends, Dean. It just gets more interesting.
Yes, it does. Well, we are going to leave it there. And Jim,
but
I just want
the world not ending, right?
The world has not ended yet.
Okay.
No, we live to fight another day here. But I wanted to thank you for your time. Always great to get together and really great to hear your views.
Dean, it was a pleasure. There's nobody I'd rather sit around a room with a couple of microphones just talking about how things ought to be in a better world.
There you go. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Dean.
Take care. You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.